"Life has a way of surprising you, doesn't it?" Ezra Hardin said. Royce nodded and started to head off. "Royce," Ezra Hardin said softly, stopping him. "We know that what happened last night wasn't pleasant. You should prepare yourself for what you're going to find."
"You think Adrian's dead?"
Royce said flatly. "I would expect so. If he is, at least know that his death may have been the sacrifice that saved our world from destruction. And, while that may not comfort you, I think we both know it would have pleased Hadrian." Royce thought a moment, nodded, then entered the trees and disappeared.
"He's definitely elvish," Arista said, shaking her head and sitting down opposite Ezra Hardin. "I don't know why I didn't see it before."
"You've grown a beard, I see."
"You just noticed?"
"I noticed before. Been kind of busy until now."
"I can't really shave, can I? It wasn't a problem while I was in Gutara, but now... Does it look all right?"
"You have some grey coming in."
"I ought to. I am 900 years old." She watched the wizard staring across the river.
"You really should practice your art. You did well in there."
She rolled her eyes.
"I can't do it. Not the way you taught me. I can do most of the things Arcadius demonstrated, but it's a bit impossible to learn hand magic from a man without hands."
"You boiled water, and you made the prison guard sneeze, remember?"
"Yes, I'm a veritable sorceress, aren't I?" she said sarcastically.
He sighed.
"What about the rain? Have you worked on that incantation any more?"
"No, and I'm not going to. I am the ambassador of Melengar now. I've put all that behind me. Given time, they may even forget I was tried for witchcraft."
"I see," the wizard said, disappointed.
The princess shivered in the morning chill and tried to run her fingers through her hair, but caught them in tangles. Stains and wrinkles dotted her dress.
"I'm a mess, aren't I?"
The wizard said nothing. He appeared to be thinking.
"So," she began, "what will you do when you find the heir?"
Ezra Hardin only stared at her.
"Is it a secret?"
"Why don't you ask me what you really want to know, Arista?" She sat, trying to look naive, and offered a slight smile.
"I don't understand."
"You aren't sitting here shivering in a wet dress, making small talk with me for nothing. You have an agenda," she asked, not at all convincingly, even for her own tastes.
"I don't know what you mean."
"You want to know if what the church told you about your father's death is true or not. You think I used you as a pawn. You are wondering if I tricked you into being an unwitting accomplice to your own father's death." The act was over. She stared, stunned at the wizard's bluntness, barely breathing. She didn't speak, but slowly nodded her head.
"I suspected they might come after you because they are having trouble following me."
"Did you?" she asked, finding her voice. "Did you orchestrate my father's death?"
Ezra Hardin let the silence hang between them a moment, then at last replied.
"Yes, Arista. I did."
At first, the princess didn't say a word. It didn't seem possible that she had heard him correctly. Slowly, her head began to shake back and forth in disbelief.
"How," she started, "how could you do that?"
"Nothing I nor anyone else says can explain that to you. Not now, at least. Perhaps someday you'll understand." Tears welled up in her eyes. She brushed them away and glared at the wizard. "Before you judge me completely, as I know you will,
Remember one thing. Right now the Church of Nephron is trying to persuade you that I am a demon, the very apostle of Uberlin. You are likely thinking they are right. But before you damn me forever and run into the embrace of the Patriarch, ask yourself these questions. Who approved your entrance into Sheridan University? Who talked your disapproving father into letting you attend? How did you learn about me? How was it that you found your way to a hidden prison that only a handful of people knew existed? Why were you taught to use a gemstone lock? And isn't it interesting that the very gem you used on your door was the same as the signet ring that unlocked the prison entrance? And how was it that a young girl, princess or not, was allowed to enter Gutara prison and leave unmolested, not once, not twice, but repeatedly for months, without her activities ever being questioned or reported back to her father, the king?
What are you saying?
Arista, the wizard said. Sharks don't eat seafood because they like it, but because chickens don't swim. We all do the best we can with the tools we have, but at some point you have to ask yourself where the tools came from. She stared at him.
You knew they would kill my father. You counted on it. You even knew they would eventually kill me and Ulrich, and yet you pretended to be my friend, my teacher.
Her face hardened.
School's over.
She turned her back on him and walked away. When Royce reached the edge of the burnt forest, he spotted a series of colourful tents set up around the old village common. The tents displayed pennants of the Nephron Church, and he could see several priests as well as imperial guards. Other figures moved slowly over the hill near the old castle grounds, but nowhere did he see anyone he knew. He kept to the cover of the trees when he caught the sound of a snapping twig not too far off. Slipping around, he quickly spotted Magnus crouched in the underbrush. The dwarf jumped in alarm and fell backward at his approach.
Relax, Royce whispered, sitting down next to where the dwarf now lay, nervously watching the thief.
Glancing down the slope, Royce realized that the dwarf had found an excellent position to watch the camp. They were on a rise behind a series of burnt trees where some of the underbrush had survived. Below, they had a perfect view of each of the tent openings, the makeshift horse corral, and the latrine. Royce guessed there were about 30 of them.
What are you still doing here? Royce asked.
I was breaking a sword for your partner, but I'm leaving now.
What happened?
Huh? Oh, Theron and Fanon were killed.
Royce nodded, showing no outward sign of surprise or grief.
Adrian, is he alive?
The dwarf nodded, and went on to explain the events that had transpired that evening.
After it was dead, or dispelled, or whatever, Thomas and I checked on Hadrian. He was unconscious, but alive. We made him comfortable, covered him with a blanket, and put a lean-to over him, the Pickering kid, and that Melengarian soldier. Before dawn, Bishop Salder and his crew returned, dragging two wagons with them. The way I figure it, either Guy reported what happened and he was coming back with help, or they heard it when the beastie died. They pulled in and, fast as rabbits, had these tents up and breakfast cooking. I spotted the sentinel in their ranks, so I hid up here. They moved Hadrian, Hilfred, and Marvin into that white tent, and soon after, they put a guard on it.
Is that all?
Well, they sent a detail out to bury the dead. Most they buried on the hill up there near the castle, including Fanon, but Thomas made some big stink and they took Theron down the road to that last farm near the river, and they buried him there.
Perhaps you forgot to mention how you found my dagger?
The Alverstone? I thought you had it.
I do, Royce said.
Magnus reached for his boot and cursed.
When you investigated my background, you must have stumbled across the fact that I survived my youth by picking pockets.
I remember something about that, the dwarf growled.
Royce pulled Alverstone from its sheath as he glared at the dwarf.
Look, I'm sorry about killing that damn king. It was just a job I was hired to do, okay? I wouldn't have taken the job if it hadn't required a uniquely challenging masonry effort. I'm not an assassin. I'm not even good enough to be considered a pathetic fighter. I'm an artisan. Truth be told, I specialize in weapons. That's my first love. But all dwarves can cut stone, so I was hired to do the tower work. Then the job got changed, and after half a year's work, I was going to be stiffed if I didn't knife the old man. In hindsight, I can see I should have refused, but I didn't. I didn't know anything about him. Maybe he was a bad king, maybe he deserved to die. Braga certainly thought so, and he was the king's brother-in-law. I try not to involve myself in human affairs, but I was caught up in this one. It's not something I wanted. It's not something I looked for. It just happened. And it's not like someone else wouldn't have done it if I hadn't.
What makes you think I'm upset you killed Amrath? I'm not even mad you trapped the tower. Closing the door on me was the mistake you made. Magnus inched away. Killing you would be as easy as... No, easier than slaughtering a fatted pig. The challenge would lie in causing the maximum amount of pain before inflicting death.
Magnus's mouth opened, but no words came out.
But you're a very lucky dwarf, because there's a man still alive in that tent who wouldn't like it, a man you covered in a blanket and put a lean-to over.
Down below, he spotted Arista as she entered the camp. She talked to a guard who pointed toward the white tent. She rushed to it. Royce looked back at the dwarf and spoke clearly and evenly.
If you ever touch Alverstone again without my permission, I'll kill you.
Magnus looked at him bitterly. Then his expression changed and he raised an eyebrow.
Without your permission? So there's a chance you'll let me study it?
Royce rolled his eyes. I'm going to get Hadrian out of there. You're going to steal two of the Archbishop's horses and walk them over to the White Tent without being spotted.
And then we can talk about the permission thing.
Royce sighed. Did I mention I hate dwarves?
But, Your Grace...
Deacon Thomas protested as he stood in the large, stripped tent before Bishop Saldor and Luis Guy. The pudgy cleric made a poor showing of himself in his frock caked with dirt and ash, his face smudged, his fingers black.
"Look at you, Thomas," Bishop Saldor said. "You're so exhausted you look as if you'll fall down any minute. You've had a long 2 days, and you've been under tremendous stress for months now. It's only natural that you might see things in the dark. No one is blaming you. And we don't think you're lying. We know that right now you believe you saw this village girl destroy the Gilarabrin. But I think if you just take a nap and rest, when you get up, you'll find that you were mistaken about a great many things.
I don't need a nap, Thomas shouted.
Calm down, Deacon,
Saldo snapped, rising abruptly to his feet.
Remember whose presence you're standing in.
The deacon cowed, and Saldor sighed. His face softened to his grandfatherly visage, and he put an arm around the man's shoulders, patting him gently.
Go to a tent and rest.
Thomas hesitated, turned, and left Salder and Louis Guy alone. The bishop threw himself down in the little cushioned chair beside a bowl of red berries some industrious servant had managed to gather for him. He popped two in his mouth and chewed. They were bitter, and he grimaced. Despite the early hour, Salder was desperate for a glass of brandy, but none had survived the flight from the castle. Only the Grace of Maribor could account for the survival of the camping gear and provisions, all of which they had lazily left in the wagons when they had first arrived at the manor. In the turmoil of their exodus, they had given little thought to provisions. That he lived at all was a miracle. He couldn't recall how he had crossed the courtyard, or how he had reached the gate. He must have run down the hill, but had no recollection of it. His memory was like a dream, vague and fading. He did remember ordering the coachman to whip the horses. The fool wanted to wait for the archbishop. The old man could barely walk, and the moment the flames hit, his servants deserted him. He had had as much chance of survival as Rufus. With Archbishop Gallian's death, the command of the church's interest in Dahlgren fell to Salder and Guy. The two inherited a disaster of mythic proportions. They were alone in the wilderness, faced with crucial decisions. How they handled them would decide the fate of future generations. Who actually held authority remained vague. Salder was a bishop, an appointed leader, while Guy was only a constabulary officer whose jurisdiction extended mostly to apostate members of the church. Still, the sentinel actually spoke with the patriarch. Salder liked Guy, but appreciation for his effectiveness wouldn't prevent him from sacrificing the sentinel if necessary. Salder was certain that if Guy still had had his knights about him, the sentinel would have taken command, and he would have had no choice but to accept it. But the Surrett were dead, and Guy himself wounded. With Gallian also dead, a door had opened, and Salder planned to be the first one through. Salder looked at Guy.
How could you let this happen?
The sentinel, who sat with his arm in a sling and his shoulder wrapped in bandages, stiffened.
I lost 7 good men and barely escaped with my life. I wouldn't call that allowing it to happen.
And how exactly did a bunch of farmers defeat the infamous Surrett?
They weren't farmers. 2 were Pickerings. And there was Hadrian Blackwater.
The Pickerings I can understand, but Blackwater? He's nothing but a rogue.
No, there's more to him. Him and his partner.
Royce and Hadrian are excellent thieves. They proved that in Melengar and again in Chadwick. Poor Archibald still has fits over them.
No, Guy said. I think they're more than that. Blackwater knows Teshlor combat, and his friend Royce Melbourne is an elf.
Salder blinked.
An elf? Are you sure?
He passes as human, but I'm certain of it.
And this is the second time we found them with Ezra Harden,
Salder muttered in concern.
Is this Hadrian still here?
He's in the infirmary tent.
Put a guard on him at once.
I've had him under guard since he was dragged to the tent. What we need to concern ourselves with is the girl. She's going to prove herself to be an embarrassment if we don't do something,
Guy said, and slipped his sword partway out of its sheath.
She's in grief over the loss of her father. It wouldn't be surprising if she threw herself over the falls in a fit of despair.
And Thomas?
Salder asked, reaching for another handful of berries.
It is clear he won't be quiet. Will you kill him too? What excuse will you give for that? And what about all the others in this camp that heard him going on all morning about her being the heir? Do we kill everyone? If we did, who would carry our bags back to Ervenon? He added with a smile.
I don't see the humor in this, Guy snapped, letting his sword slide back down in its sheath.
Perhaps that's because you're not looking at it the right way, Salder told him.
Guy was a well-trained and vicious guard dog, but the man lacked imagination.
What if we didn't kill her? What if we actually made her the Empress?
A peasant girl? Empress? Guy scoffed. Are you mad?
Despite his political clout, I don't think any of us, including the Patriarch, were particularly happy with the choice of Rufus. He was a fool, to be sure, but he was also a stubborn, powerful fool. We all suspected that he might have had to be killed within a year, which would have thrown the infant empire into turmoil. How much better would it be to have an empress that would do whatever she was told right from the very start?
But how could we possibly sell her to the nobles?
We don't, Saldo said, and a smile appeared on his wrinkled face. We sell her to the people instead.
How's that?
Deegan Gaunt's nationalist movement proved that the people themselves have strength. Earls, barons, even kings are afraid of the power which that commoner can gather. A word from him could launch a peasant uprising. Lords would have to kill their own people, their own source of revenue, just to keep order. This presents them with the undesirable choice of accepting either poverty or death. The landholders will do almost anything to avoid such an event. What if we tapped that? The peasants already revere the church. They follow its teachings as divine truth. How much more inspiring would it be to offer them a leader plucked from their own stock, a ruler who is one of them and able to truly understand the plight of the poor, the unwashed, the destitute? Not only is she a peasant queen, but she's also the heir of Novron, and all the wonderful expectations that go with that. Indeed, in our greatest hour of need, Maribor has once again delivered unto his people a divine leader to show us the way out of darkness. We could send bards across the land repeating the epic tale of the pure, chaste girl who slew the elven demon that even Lord Rufus was powerless against. We'll call it Rufus's Bane. Yes, I like it. So much better than the unpronounceable Gilarabrin.
But can she be made to play her part? Guy asked.
You saw her. She's nearly comatose. Not only does she have no place to go, no friends or relatives, no money or possessions, she's also emotionally shattered. She'd slit her own wrists, I suspect, if she gets a knife. Still, the best part is that once we establish her as Empress, once we have the support of the people so fervently on our side, no noble landholder would dare challenge us. We can do what we planned to do with Rufus. Only instead of a messy murder that would certainly invite suspicion and accusations, with a girl, we can simply marry her. The new husband will rule as emperor, and we can lock her in a dark room somewhere, pulling her out for wintertide showings.
Guy smiled at that.
"Do you think the Patriarch will agree?" Saldor asked him. "Perhaps we should send a rider back today."
"No. This is too important. I'll go myself. I'll leave as soon as I can saddle a horse. In the meantime,
In the meantime, we will announce that we are considering the possibility that this girl is the heir, but will not accept her unconditionally until a full investigation is conducted. That should buy us a month.
If the Patriarch agrees, then we can send out rabble-rousers to incite the people with rumours that the Church is being forced by the nobles and the monarchs not to reveal the girl as the true heir. The people will be denouncing our enemies and demanding that she take the throne before we even announce her.
She will make the perfect figurehead, Guy said.
Solda looked up, picturing the future.
An innocent girl linked with a mythic legend. Her beautiful name will be everywhere, and she will be loved.
The bishop paused and thought,
What is her name, anyway?
I think Thomas called her Thrace.
Seriously?
Solda grimaced.
Well, no matter. We'll change it. After all, she's ours now.
Royce looked around. There wasn't a single sentry left outside. Several still moved about on the hilltop, but they were far enough away to ignore. Satisfied, he ducked through the flap of the white tent. Inside he found Tobias, Hadrian, Marvin, and Hilfred on cots. Hadrian was naked to his waist, his head and chest wrapped in white bandages, but he was awake and sitting up. Marvin, though still pale, was alert, his bandages bright white. Hilfred lay wrapped like a mummy, and Royce couldn't be sure if he was awake or sleeping. Arista stood bent over his cot, checking on him.
"I was wondering when you would get here," Hadrian said.
Arista turned.
"Yes, I thought you would have arrived much sooner."
"Sorry. You know how it is when you're having fun. You lose all track of time. But I did locate your weapons."
"Again?"
"You know how upset you get when you don't have your swords. Can you ride?"
"If I can walk, why not?"
He raised an arm, and Royce offered his shoulder, helping him to stand.
"What about me?"
Marvin asked, holding his side and sitting up on his cot.
"You're not going to leave me, are you?"
"You have to take him," Arista declared. "He killed two of Guy's men."
"Can you ride?" Royce asked.
"If I had a horse under me, I could at least hang on."
"What about Thrace?"
Hadrian asked.
"I don't think you need worry about her," Royce told him.
"I was just by the bishop's tent. Thomas is demanding that they declare her empress."
"Empress?"
Hadrian said, stunned.
"She killed the Gilarabrin right in front of the deacon. I guess it made an impression."
"But what if they don't? We can't leave her."
"Don't worry about Thrace," Arista said. "I'll see she's taken care of. Now, you all need to get out of here."
"Theron wanted at least one of his children to be successful," Hadrian muttered.
"But Empress?"
"You need to hurry," Arista said,
helping Royce pull Marvin to his feet. She gave all three of them a kiss and a gentle hug, and then pushed them out like a mother sending her children to school. Outside the tent, Magnus arrived with three saddled horses. The dwarf looked around nervously and whispered,
"I could have sworn I saw guards watching this tent earlier."
"You did," Royce replied. "Three horses. You read my mind."
"I figured I needed one for myself," the dwarf replied, pointing at the shortened stirrups.
He looked at Marvin with a scowl.
"Now it looks like I'll need to get another."
"Forget it," Royce whispered. "Ride with Marvin. Take it slow and make sure he stays in the saddle."
Royce helped Hadrian up onto a grey mare, then started to chuckle to himself.
"What is it?"
Hadrian asked.
"Mouse."
"What's that?"
Royce pointed to the horse Hadrian sat on.
Of all the animals he had to choose from, the dwarf stole Mouse.
Royce led them away from the camp, walking the horses across the scorched land, where the ash muffled their movement.
He kept a close eye on the distant sentries. No outcry, no shouts, no one appeared to notice, and soon they slipped into the leafy forest. Once there, he turned back toward the river in order to throw off anyone who might look for their tracks. Once he had them safe in a shallow glen near the Nidwalden, Royce ordered them to stay put while he went back. He crept up to the edge of the burned area. The camp was as it had been before. Satisfied they had made a clean escape, he walked back toward the river. He found himself on the trail that led to the Woods farm and the shell of the old building. Inexplicably, the fire had never reached this far, and it remained untouched. There was one change, however. In the center of the yard, where they had first seen the old farmer sharpening his scythe, there was a mound of earth. A stack of stones borrowed from the walls of the farmhouse circled the oblong mound. At its head, driven into the ground, was a broad plank, and burned into it were the words, "Theron Wood, Farmer." Royce could just make out the additional words scratched into the plank below that. "Father of the Empress." As Royce stood reading the words, he noticed it, a chill making the hair on his skin stand up. Someone was watching him. On the edge of his sight, a figure stood in the trees. Another stood to his left. He sensed more behind him. He turned his head, focused his eyes to see who they were. Nothing. All he saw were trees. He glanced to his left, and again, nothing. He stood still, listening. Not a twig snapped, nor a leaf crinkled, but he could still feel it. He moved away from the clearing into the brush and circled around. He moved as quietly as he could, but when he stopped, he was alone. Royce stood, puzzled. He looked for tracks where he had seen the figures, but none existed, not even a bent blade of grass. At last he gave up and returned to where he had left the others. "All's well?" Hadrian asked, sitting atop Mouse with the sun on his bare shoulders and his chest wrapped in broad strips of white cloth. "I suppose," he said, mounting up. He led them southwest, along the highlands near the falls, following a deer trail that cut through the deep forest. It was the same trail he had found in his hours searching for a tunnel to the tower. Hadrian and Marvin appeared to be doing better than expected, though each of them winced in pain whenever his horse took a misstep. Royce continued to look back over his shoulder, but nothing was ever there. By mid-afternoon, they had cleared the trees and found the main road leading south to Auburn. Here they paused to check Marvin's and Hadrian's bandages. Marvin started to bleed again, but it wasn't bad, and Magnus turned out to be almost as good a nurse as he was a swordsmith, fashioning a new pad for his side. Royce searched through the saddlebags and found Hadrian a suitable shirt. "We should be fine," Royce told them, going through their inventory. "With a little luck, we should reach Medford in a week." "In a hurry, are you?" Hadrian asked. "You might say that."
"Thinking about Gwen?"
"I'm thinking it's time I told her a few things about myself." Hadrian smiled and nodded.
"You think Thrace will be all right?"
"Thomas seems to be watching out for her pretty well."
"Do you think they'll really make her empress?"
"Not a chance." Royce shook his head and handed the shirt to him. "What do you plan on doing now?" Royce asked Magnus. The dwarf shrugged.
"You mean assuming you don't kill me?"
"I'm not going to kill you, but your old employer, the church, might, now that you've turned on them. They'll be coming after you just the same as they'll be after Marvin and Hadrian. And without the church's support, you won't last long on your own. Towns in Avron aren't too friendly to your kind.
nowhere is.
That's what I meant.
Royce sighed. I know of a very out-of-the-way place you might be able to hold up at. A place the church isn't likely to visit. They need a lot of stonework done and could use an experienced craftsman like you.
How do they feel about dwarves?
I don't think you'll have a problem. They're the kind of people who tend to like everyone.
I could do with getting back to stone cutting, Magnus nodded.
Myron will drive him crazy with his quest to get the monastery exactly the way it was, Hadrian said. They've gone through 5 builders so far.
I know, Royce replied with a little grin. Royce climbed back on top of Mouse as Magnus went ahead to check on Morven. Hadrian shook out his shirt before slipping his arm in the sleeve.
Arista told me you two were with Ezra Harden in the tower last night. She said he needed help with something, but wouldn't tell me what it was.
He was using the tower to look for the heir of Novron, Royce replied.
Did he find him?
I think so. But you know how Ezra is. It's hard to be sure of anything when dealing with him.
Hadrian nodded and winced as he pulled the shirt over his shoulders.
Having troubles?
You try getting dressed with broken ribs sometime. It isn't so easy.
Royce continued to look at him.
What is it? Am I that entertaining?
Hadrian asked. It's just that you've worn that silver medallion ever since I've known you, but you never told me where you got it.
Hmm? This? Hadrian said. I've had this forever. My father left it to me.
The End. This has been a Sci-Fi audio production of Theft of Swords, Volume 1 of the Rhaera Revelations by Michael J. Sullivan, narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds and directed by Abigail McHugh. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Volume 2 of the Rhaera Revelations by Michael J. Sullivan, Rise of Empire, also narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds. The Kingdom of Melengar is struggling as it defiantly stands alone against the newly formed empire. As war approaches, King Ulric calls upon the aid of Royce and Hadrian in a desperate gamble to form an alliance with the nationalists to the south. But Royce has plans of his own, and uses this opportunity to discover if Rhaera has simply become the pawns of an ancient wizard in his own bid for power. But to find the truth involves unravelling Hadrian's hidden past. What he discovers will lead them to the end of the known world on a journey rife with treachery and intrigue. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.